Hello everyone, welcome to Quantum Nurse Freedom International live stream. And we are again very excited to be able to come together with our regular special guest, Alex Craner, who is also, who's been with us a number of times. And he, you know, with Alex, I know that we could always have that interesting conversation of truth and freedom. And he is, his mind is so holistic, and he looks at many things from a macro and then to the micro. And we're just happy that Roy and I can come together, as Alex was wondering what happened to the rest of us. But as we are all aware, each of us are going through maybe difficult times, difficult situations. So for all of you out there who would have wished to join us right now as a co-host for Alex Craner and also for other things that you do, we wish that you are in good state of mind and health. So, and for anyone who resonates to this conversation, please remember to like it and share it, at least maybe share it to six of your friends. We're not asking for so much. And then when you're able, always support our guests in their contact information. And for Alex, it will be at alexcraner.substack.com. And you could always, again, donate any amount or definitely share the information, okay? And thank you. So Alex, welcome. And I'm glad you're in good state of mind, and I look forward to many more. And I envy a little bit of the fact that you're traveling to Asia next month, but it's all for good. And you're in good hands with other favorite people of ours, like Matthew and his wife. Alex, I hope you could also meet Brian Berlitic there. He lives in, you know?
Yes, he was invited, but as of yet, I don't know whether he will attend. I tried to reach out to him, but I wasn't able to get his contact.
Maybe in the last moment, you know, he loves that country. He loves what
he... Well, he lives there, no?
Yep, he lives there, you know. And so, you know, he speaks very highly of the country in terms of what they're accomplishing in relationship to the economy, and so you all could come together from the east and the west and from all angles of the world. So, Alex, I as usual, I like to start with with your Substack article that right away from the title that it's attractive to me, and the untangling the socialism versus capitalism dichotomy. And so look for those of you, go to alexcraner.substack and be a subscriber. I don't know, I mean, you're the perfect person to help us understand and walk us through socialism and capitalism because of your background of having lived it. And for me, I'll just share to you that when I was growing in the Philippines, growing up there, I just thought that part of my years in my young life that we were connected with a lot of socialist movement and some gearing towards communist movement, we were kind of like, I just thought that people who gain a lot of wealth or who are wealthy, who are rich, they become rich just because they take advantage of other people. So sometimes that's right away it goes into someone's mind that you cannot be economically or financially well and support yourself unless you're taking advantage of your workers or your employees or something else. And then on the other hand, when I'm around a lot of people who are engaged in the socialist movement, it seems like we just want to keep demanding from the government of what's to be given to us. Just ask. So, please That's really, I don't have an immediate question right now, although maybe I'd like you to share also, is there a particular country that really, that is mostly capitalist and if they're doing well, or if they're mostly socialist and are they doing well? When I say they, the people. So help us and thank you.
Well, thank you, Grace. Very good to be with you again. Those are all very, very important questions. And I would, to answer your question, if there was a country that got it right, I could name France as one of them, but not now, maybe 20 years ago. I think that there used to be a publication, or maybe there still is a publication in the United States, I think it was Condé Nast. And they used to run an annual survey of quality of life. And France used to always come up top. I'm talking about mid-1990s. And Condé Nast would take a lot of different parameters into account, like the quality of schools, security on the streets, how close people on average are from a doctor or a clinic or a hospital, how easy it was to get an appointment with a doctor, even a specialist. The presence of parks and playgrounds, employment conditions, and so on and so forth. And then they would create on all those parameters a kind of a quality of life index. And I remember that at least 2 years in a row in the 1990s that I read, so this was kind of before the internet when I still read magazines, France was coming in as number one in the world. And, you know, living here, I could see why. You know, it was it's gone downhill very badly over the last 20 years. But it really was a good place. You could see the quality of produce that you buy in France is second to none, really. I think that the life of the average Frenchman was better than the life of the average American or any other country. So I think that was very legitimate. And France is a capitalist country, but it had a strong, strong social movement. So the French people are very well known for not taking any nonsense. And they're very quick to rebel, and they're very quick to go on strike and claim their rights, or, you know, whatever it is that they deem is fair, which generally means reasonable work hours, good pay, generous overtime, things like this, you know. France doesn't buy that whole working hard mentality where you're a hero if you work three jobs and completely neglect your family and don't have a life whatsoever. All your waking hours are dedicated to running after money so that you can pay with bills and have nothing left over. And then people say like, oh, you know, you work so hard. That's so great. Except, you know, you're living a life of a zombie. And so the whole question of socialism versus capitalism is not very well understood, because you have one side, you know, let's say the people who think of themselves as capitalists, who thinks that people who like socialism are just people who are lazy, don't want to work, and want to get free stuff from the government. That's how they perceive it. So they're sometimes very hostile to the idea of socialism without really understanding what we're talking about. And then you have people who think that everybody who is rich is evil, and that everybody should have the same. And both sides are wrong. Because, you know, yes, there are some people who are rich because they took advantage of other people. That's true. But there are some people who are rich because Maybe they wrote a beautiful novel. Maybe they wrote a bestseller. Maybe they are successful artists or painters. Maybe they made an invention that changed the life of everybody else, and they got a few cents on every widget that's sold around the world, you know. And so some people are rich and some people are not. That's just the way it is. Forcing equality, that is equality of outcome, is probably the worst kind of approach to fixing the ills of society, because it gives free stuff to some and it punishes others, and it punishes the wrong side and it rewards the wrong side. Do you know what I mean? But on the other hand, also saying that nobody should get anything unless they earned it and they hold three jobs and work themselves into the ground, or else they may as well be homeless and poor, is also very wrong. And, you know, we see the results of this on the streets of the United States cities and British cities, where there's just like more and more and more and more homeless people. Well, you know, if you live in that country, and even if you're a capitalist in your mindset and you want to run a successful business, wouldn't you prefer that all those people who are out on the street actually had something to spend? Because they might become your customers and you might earn money from them. And instead, they're on the street, maybe where your sons and daughters are going to school. Or maybe they're right outside your house. So that's not good either. So there has to be a balance. But the balance doesn't have to be, created in any kind of a draconian way where you steal money from one side and you give it to the other side. That is already being done. And I have to explain this. So I think that maybe I probably should have started to set up why both systems that we have today are not sustainable. Both what we think is capitalism and what we think is socialism, neither one works, neither one is sustainable, and things that are not sustainable, that they have to eventually fail. And so to explain this, I have to go into a bit of an economics explanation that maybe people will have to rewind and hear it again, but they can find an explanation on my Substack article. It's two key paragraphs that, you know, if you don't get it the first time, read it again. It's not very complicated, but it needs to be understood because if we are going to fix our current predicaments, we have to understand what the problem is. So here it goes. To analyze an economic system, we're going to simplify and we're going to think of a closed system, meaning we're going to pretend like there's no imports, there's no exports, okay? There's just like a community that produces a certain amount of goods and services. The thing to keep in mind is that the total of all the price tags that are attached to these goods and services is the aggregate cost of the system's output. So it represents the amounts of money expended by the businesses on things like raw materials and wages and rents and interest on loans, as well as the entrepreneur's profits. And these sums are income to those who receive them and also comprise the system's total purchasing power. So on the whole, the aggregate costs, aggregate incomes and aggregate prices are all the same because they represent the different sides of the same transactions. So the prices at which the system's output can be sold in the marketplace are determined by the total amount of money which is available for spending in a given period of time. And for the system to be in equilibrium, to be balanced, the aggregate prices of goods and services put on the market should exactly absorb the system's total purchasing power. Now, here's where the problem comes into the equation. Because with the current monetary system, there are two major factors which systematically reduce the system's purchasing power in every cycle. One is the savings, and the other one is the repayment of debt. So let's say that all the people who work earn their income, and that income is the purchasing power that's available to absorb all the produce, all the products and services produced. So first problem is that most people don't spend all the money that they earn. They always keep 5-10% of what they earn as savings for a rainy day. So that already reduces the purchasing power that's available in the system. The second one is the repayment of debts. So with the monetary system that we have, every time you pay back your debt, you extinguish the money, because all the money, except for the coins and bills, so 97% of all the money in the circulation represents debts. When you pay back the debt, that money disappears. So all the repayment of debt extinguishes money, so that further reduces the available purchasing power in the system. Okay, so this creates a problem, because all the businesses put out their products and services at a certain price, and they, with that price, they expect to be able to pay their rents and the raw materials and the wages and earn some profits and pay back the interest on the loans and so forth. And now they can't sell everything they produced at those prices, because in the system as a whole, part of the purchasing power has been withdrawn. So what do they have to do? They have to lower the prices if they are to sell everything. Now that means that they're not going to make any profits, and they might have difficulty paying rent and wages. And so in the next cycle, they may have to shut down some capacities, reduce, they have to scale back, which means that maybe they have to let go some of their employees, which means that there's going to be even less purchasing power. So it creates like a self-sustaining cycle, which is colloquially called the deflationary death spiral. And without any intervention from the outside, the system would stabilize at the depression level of activity, meaning that the system would only produce the necessities that people absolutely have to buy, bread and milk, and maybe some services like trash collection but the system would be in a depression economically. Now, our governments, for a reason that's also rooted in the nature of the money that we have, always have to pursue economic growth. For as long as you've lived, all you've heard is economic growth and economic growth. It's as if we always have to grow. Like next year, we always have to produce more crap than the last year, and then the year after that, more crap than this year, and so on forever. And the reason why this is, because if you don't grow the economy, it automatically goes into this deflationary death spiral. Now, the only way to achieve this, absent, let's say, some discovery of new gold mines or, some unpredictable event that from time to time can endogenously push the system towards growth. But, in general, this maintaining growth necessitates government intervention. And just taxing and spending is not enough, because it doesn't create new purchasing power. Taxation simply shifts existing purchasing power from the people who earned it to the government. So there's no bridging of this gap between the purchasing power necessary to keep the system in balance and the reduction by savings and debt repayments. This is called deflationary gap, because it causes deflation. So the only way to bridge the usual way that the deflationary gap is bridged in modern governments with the modern monetary system is that the governments get into debt and they engage in deficit spending. So all the governments of all the capitalist countries everywhere around the world continually mount more and more and more debts, and they continue with deficit spending, meaning they spend more money than they receive in tax revenues, because they have to, because otherwise they get depression. All right. So the problem with all this is that government generally becomes progressively bigger and bigger participant in the economy. So whether you think your country is a capitalist country or a socialist country, it's always socialist, because the government role is practically baked into the economic equation. So you have it in the United States. In France, government now is more than half the GDP. And in every country, even if they think they're super capitalists, governments are always a huge participant in the gross domestic product. And all the promises by politicians that they want to balance the budgets, that they want to go back to small government, no role of government in the economy, blah, 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 blah. Javier Milei, for example, they are either lying or they have no idea what they're talking about. And it never works. It's been promised for decades and it never works. Look, all you have to do is look at the progression of deficit spending of any government you want. German, British, American, Australian, anywhere. And okay, so now so this is a given that the government has a role in the economy. It must, and that their participation is always bigger and bigger and bigger. Now we come to what is actually the difference between what people perceive as socialism and what people perceive as capitalism. In quote-unquote capitalist economies, government intervention flows top-down, meaning that government distributes money through large corporations and large banks. So they feed big pharma, big agriculture, big banks, big military industrial complex, and so forth. So all those corporations, they lobby the governments and they get these massive contracts, usually no compete contracts. And so billions, hundreds of billions of dollars from the government flow into these large corporations. In countries that we perceive as quote unquote socialist countries, the programs direct more money, more new purchasing power is injected bottom up. So they give more generous social benefits, free healthcare, free or cheap healthcare and education. They spend money on infrastructure projects that employ a lot of unemployed people on things that maybe, you know, weren't essential and weren't urgent to build, but the government builds it anyway, so it keeps people off the street and keeps them employed, and so forth. That's the essential difference between what is discussed commonly as socialism versus what is discussed commonly as capitalism. Okay, so with that, I would conclude only with this observation that when you inject supplemental purchasing power top down, you run the risk of cultivating fascism, because all these lobbyists and the corporations they lobby for are becoming more and more powerful, and they get more and more political power to influence the political process. And so you get a military industrial complex that is completely out of control, that is, you know, fomenting and triggering and provoking and engineering wars to keep themselves in more and more lucrative business perpetually. Whereas if the supplemental purchasing power is being fed bottom up, then, you know, you don't have people sleeping on the streets.
you usually have full employment. You have people who are less anxious about money because they enjoy more generous pensions and unemployment benefits from the government. And let's say you have a better balanced society, better quality of life for everyone involved. And that includes the wealthy people. Because again, you know, if you're a wealthy man and you own a business, wouldn't you prefer that even if you think that people don't deserve it, even if you rail and bitch about welfare queens and all this stuff, isn't it better if those welfare queens had money to spend and maybe they come to your business and buy something and make you richer rather than them being out on the street, desperate, thinking about maybe breaking into your house or kidnapping your children to extract money from you? So, you know, these are political choices. These are choices that legitimately belong to the people. And people should have a say in how they shape the society that they live in. And I think that the conventional discussion of socialism versus of capitalism really underserves the people, because we're throwing around labels. People kind of like polarize apart, one side thinking that we hate these people, the other side thinking we hate the other people. But, you know, it's a question of striking a balance where you don't have to punish people for being successful. At any rate, there's greater than 90% chance that somebody who's wealthy today, by the third generation, they're not going to be, you know, wealth shifts and migrates. And then making sure that people are okay, that people are live with a certain level of dignity, and that you can regard those people legitimately as your potential customers rather than people who are littering the streets and using sidewalks as a public toilet. So anyway, I think that's the proper discussion that we should have, because then at some point we need to weigh in and say, we can't let this thing go out of control completely and then get things like, you know, like things you see in so many US cities today, and cities in Britain, and increasingly cities in France and Germany. You know, it's all deteriorating. It's all going the way, by the way, of this top-down capitalism.
It's happening in Dublin as well now. You're seeing the tent, yeah, yes. The tents all around the place. But just based on what you were saying there, like the, you know, the government's giving money to the big boys. I remember 10, 20 years ago, you know, one of the magazines I was subscribed to, Business Plus, and I was looking, Enterprise Ireland would be basically an organization, and it's kind of, it would have a place in Warsaw and stuff like that, but it's basically this to help the small boy kind of invest, and they give money to make the company grow. And I had all the statistics for it, and it was like Kerrygold, all the big pharma were getting millions, and I was like, how come they're giving? I couldn't understand it. I was like, they're giving the money to the people that don't need it. And I mean, it's like the small boy that has a great invention that doesn't have the funding. Yes. They should be throwing it at him, but they don't. They refuse. They just have so much paperwork and loopholes. And it's such a sick system. And I'm assuming that's replicated around the world.
Yes, yes. This is the neoliberal economic system that is being replicated everywhere, and unfortunately has a huge tendency to ultimately benefit the most the military-industrial complex in every country, because, you know, every kind of spending is usually contested by somebody else. So, I don't know, you want to buy a highway, you want to build a high-speed railways in your country, like United States could use them. It's a huge country, right? Well, somebody will say like, well, that's not the role of government. That should be private investment. This is, we're veering off into socialism, blah, blah, blah. And so, you know, the result is that the United States never built, you know, the richest country in the world, never built a single mile of high-speed railways. Their train tracks all across the countries are falling apart. It's pitiful. They're still stuck in the 1950s and 1960s. Whereas when it comes to the military-industrial complex, all you have to claim is that somebody, you know, you have to invent enemies. And then you beat the patriotism drum and national security drum. And then who's going to say no to national security? You know, being weak on national security is political poison pill. So nobody dares. And so every time Raytheon and GE or Lockheed Martin says, Russians have better missiles than us. We need another $100 million. No, not million, billion dollars to develop even better missiles. Well, who's going to say no? They don't dare say no. So they just keep throwing endless piles of money into productions of goods that don't benefit anyone. They're being produced to be destroyed. So the only people who benefit from that are the shareholders, the bondholders, the executive class, and then a little bit of trickle down to the ordinary employees. But you know, these employees, if they don't work for the military industrial complex, they have no jobs. So even they are desperate for that. And so you kind of create like this perpetual motion machine that, you know, like a snake that eats its tail. They need more war to get more money, to hire more people, to spend more money, and then they lobby for more war and so forth. And it becomes a completely perverse system. And now we see it happening in Germany again. Germany was also a social state where, you know, people enjoyed relatively decent standards of living and relatively generous safety net from the government and good infrastructure and good safe streets. That's all going away now. And now they instituted this debt break as a law of the land in Germany, which means that government has limited the growth of new debt to only a certain percentage of the GDP. I don't know what it is exactly. And what that means in actuality is austerity, that they are cutting back on all the social programs that benefit the people. But just this week, you know, their defense minister went on TV, ZDF channel, and gave an interview in which he said, like, oh, well, you know, yes, we have to, you know, we have to not let the debts run amok, but we have to make an exception for the defense industry, because all the bike lanes in the world and all the digital libraries in the world won't serve us any good, won't do us any good if we are under attack, because the Russians might attack us. So they're already creating this narrative where the defense industry has to be an exception. So now their largest defense contractor, Rheinmetall, is on this wild spending spree. They're building new production facilities and they're buying up their rivals and competitors because they want to become either Europe's or world's biggest producer of ammunitions. Okay, so it's happening in the real time in Germany. And then, you know, Rheinmetall is going to become a very powerful corporation. Kind of reminds of IG Farben from 1930s. And then they themselves are going to have a very strong incentive for their weapons to get used so that the government has to order more. So they're going to be very keen on, you know, waging wars around the world and selling weapons to governments around the world. So this sick system is perpetuating itself. And if you say something about it, somebody will scream socialist at you without really understanding what they're saying.
And is it BlackRock? They seemingly got some contract for Ukraine, for building Ukraine, which is kind of strange.
Oh, yes, of course,
And like the thing with that is most people don't realize anything with rebuilding should be competitive tendering, but it's not. It's like, this is what it is. And your country then is paying for that. So you're basically in debt for the rest of your life.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So you're in debt for the rest of your life. The debt always falls back on the people's back, of the ordinary people's back, who are being shafted in the process because the money that's being spent on the military industrial complex is taken away from things like having safe streets, policing, firefighters, good hospitals, good schools, and all of those things that make life, that contribute to a high standard of living. And you end up getting Ukraine, or you end up getting Germany of the 1930s all over again. And I think it's time we wake up to these stupid pathogenic schemes and push back and say, no, we're not afraid of a Russian invasion. We don't want Rheinmetall to become the king of the land and the chief lobbyists of our governments who end up naming people to the cabinet post. And then just today, the same ZDF that interviewed German Defense Minister Boris Pistorius did something completely sickening in manipulating the public opinion in the direction of militarization of German society. This is on Twitter. I posted it on my Twitter feed. Somebody managed to film the whole sequence of what happened. So there was a farmer protest. I don't know which city in Germany it was, but there was a lot of people in this farmer protest. And then they show a man walking towards the group of farmers with a single placard. And then behind that man came the whole film crew of the ZDF channel. And that man had a placard that says, "More arms for Ukraine," right? And he gets to the farmer protest, enters the crowd, and turns around towards the camera, showing his placard, making it look as though all these German people gathered to protest in favor of giving more weapons to Ukraine. And then the farmers realized what was being done, and they started booing and hissing, and they pushed the man out of the crowd. And then he left. And then the ZDF crew interviews him with his placard, still pretending that the whole crowd was there along with him, demonstrating in favor of Germany producing more arms for Ukraine. So, you know, not only Boris Pistorius, the defense minister, was lobbying, but that even the film crews of the media company play these sick games of deception where they take a legitimate protest, completely mischaracterize it in order to create a public perception that the German people are in favor of this rearmament and militarization. And so when the politicians write 100 billion checks to Rheinmetall, then they say, like, but of course, you know, this is the democratic will of the German people. This is how it should be. And people say, like, oh, well, I guess, yeah, all those people were demonstrated. So, okay, never mind, carry on. So
I've seen that, like Antifa as well. And loads of times they'd have their own military people in with the crowds, then starting the trouble. And they'd say, oh, and they got caught a few times because they actually caught them with their shoes. They had the military boots on, even though they had different clothing. So, like, this happens all around the world. And I think it's kind of like, you know, we get into a different frequency where we see things. And thankfully, a lot more people are kind of waking up to what's going on. But, like, since you're into finance, right, I just want to, because, like, with BlackRock and everything, there was a guy who had done a video of all the kind of cosmetics, and he was saying it's all 95% is owned, even though you think you have a choice. And then he kind of went further with a different video showing, like, BlackRock, Vanguard, Fidelity, and all this, and they all own each other. And it's like, sort of like sometimes people think Coca-Cola is against Pepsi. They're all owned by the same people. So the reality is, even the military things like Raytheon and all these different things, like, they're all owned by the same corporations. So it's like one thing controlling the whole lot around the world, and people think they have a choice.
Yes. And usually you have two political parties and they're both controlled by the same people. And then they fight a little bit about, well, maybe USA flag or a rainbow flag, or maybe St. Patrick's Day should be about, you know, St. Patrick, or maybe it should be about transgender
visibility. Who's a Welsh, by the way, you
whatever.
Know that.
But, you know, regardless of that, I would like to go back to those, to that fake perception of the public will, because there's a huge danger in that. You know, what we just saw in Ukraine over the last 9 years, almost 10, no, last 10 years, should send a chill down every person's spine, because Ukraine has somehow been maneuvered into a devastating war against Russia. And they lost something close to 500,000 young men in that war. And it's not a war that the Ukrainian people wanted. Okay? Ukrainians were very much in favor of peace with Russia, normalization with Russia. That's why they elected Zelensky with such overwhelming support in 2019. After the coup took place in 2014, the two far right parties in Ukraine, the Svoboda Party and the Right Sector, together got 1.6% of the vote. So they were very unpopular. But somehow they managed to get that whole country into a war. And even as recently as, I think it was February 2022. So that's just before the beginning of the special military operation in Ukraine by Russia. A Ukrainian Institute for Sociology, I forget, Kiev International Institute of Sociology, ran a poll asking people if they would be willing to defend Ukraine with arms, with, you know, with weapons. And only 11% of the respondents said yes. So 89% of Ukrainians didn't want to fight the war, but somehow they were coerced. So the reason why I say this is that we see the beginning of this process in Europe, in Poland, in Germany, in France, in many nations in Europe, you know, Finland, Sweden, the Baltic states. You have the beginning of this process where capital is starting to flow into the armaments industries. Politicians are talking about conscriptions, about war, about confronting Russia, about sending troops to Ukraine or whatever. They're talking about Russia planning to overrun, you know, Poland and the Baltics and maybe Germany and maybe France and maybe going to, you know, to the channel across the sea from Britain. All of this is slowly gaining momentum, and people shrug their shoulders and they think like, wow, this is crazy. Well, maybe Ukrainians in 2014 thought this was crazy, but now several million Ukrainians have family members who are buried under Ukrainian flags. And if we merely shrug our shoulders and think this is crazy, it could be our children next. So we have to take this extremely seriously.
And then we have to as well, haven't they? Because it was like 20 to 27, but now it's something like 24. And I'm not sure which country. Is it Europe or something? But they're trying to make it 17 that you come into the military. So every single thing that's happening in Europe is all gearing for war. And people are just...
It's all... You know, they're inching in that direction, like, oh, maybe conscription, oh, maybe we lower the age here. 100% you're going to see greater, you know, like the organizations equivalent to Hitler's brown shirts are going to start to become more visible, and they're going to start to gradually become better funded. They're going to start to attract a lot of unemployed youth. So, you know, the deindustrialization and immiseration of the population in general is being done deliberately. And so we are being pushed in that direction. And then at one point, what's going to happen is the same as with Ukraine. You know, they're gonna push until they hit some kind of a detonation trigger, and then it's going to be, well, we have to defend our countries against the Russians or the Chinese or whoever. And then it's going to be too late to resist, you know, because once the war gets going, it kind of changes the collective psyche in a country.
It's because they're all connected, like, as we mentioned about the tents and all, because like in Ireland and all these places, and what I've seen is there are evicting people in the UK, and now they're using all these military people that we see that are kind of so-called refugees, even though there's no men and women coming in. And is it a case of you're on the ground when you're living in a tent, you're just in survival mode, and they'll go, hey, come fight, you'll have a meal, you'll have this. I mean, that, yes, could be part of the plan as well.
But that could be, that could definitely be a part of the plan. Those are not going to be great soldiers, to be sure, you know. But they don't care. They need cannon fodder. They genuinely need cannon fodder. And all of these migrants that they're bringing in, they will all end up in the uniform. You know, so that's the direction that we are already set in. And I think that if we don't want to see our sons under the flag of France or Germany or Poland or whatever, we need to push back and push back like their lives depended on it.
Are you kind of familiar with what went on in Ireland? Because there was a referendum recently, and they were... I mean, basically, Ireland is made up of Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, and the Green Party, which would be in most countries left and right. But for the last 10 years, they had to come together to kind of get a majority vote. And then you had the opposition, which is Sinn Féin, and it was like people before profit. And at some stage, people were thinking these are better. But then you saw they were pushing the same agenda and everything. So there was nobody that was good. But with these referendums, there was a few people came out and started explaining exactly what they were doing. Every single political party was saying vote yes. And there was like 79% said no. So it didn't go through, which was fantastic to see.
Yeah.
The leader, yeah. I'm not sure, is it that because they're kind of, was it because when he went on Patrick's Day to America and started talking about Gaza and, you know, the Palestine, but he resigned and he's a young guy, which never happens. There's a load of TDs from the political party that's in power resigning from their ministerial positions. That never happens. And I saw there's a third of the party said they're not going to contest the next election. That is really strange that this is happening. You never see anything like that. And I'm trying to, I honestly know something's up, but I haven't figured it out yet. And I'm just curious, do you know what's going on?
Well, no, I don't. But it seems to me that there really is a genuine awakening among the people. And I think that the ruling establishment really have lost control of the narrative. And I think that what we see is the outcome of that, which, you know, which is really, really encouraging grounds for optimism, but we have to keep it up. You know, we have to keep it up because they realize their problem. And, you know, you saw in January in Davos, they were all throwing tantrums about misinformation and disinformation and how this is a greater threat to our whatever rules-based order, even than terrorism, and even greater threat than Russia. Oh my God, you know, that's us, you know, that's basically us. So we are now a greater threat to them than Russia or the terrorists, which is awesome. So I think we have to keep going. We have to keep talking. We have to keep raising our voice and seeding the system with 100 million points of friction. Like everything they try to do, we need to push back, not comply, laugh in their faces, and hold our line together.
Because, like, you grew up in communist Yugoslavia, and then you went to the US, and so you've kind of seen from both sides. And I'm just curious how kind of governments, the way that they manipulate people. Because I'll give you an example. In Ireland, we don't have jaywalking, as they call it, or, you know, you just, there's nothing coming, you cross the road. And in Poland, you get a fine for doing that, like in America. And I've seen so many people getting knocked down. It's like the man, it goes green, and, you know, the side road can turn. I always look, but they don't. They just cross the road. And the same thing with, like, say, a tram. The people, they see the tram they want, the old people, they'll run across a main motorway to catch the tram. It's like their thinking has missed. And I just want, like, when the government takes too much control, people stop thinking. And what I've noticed is when people go away, say, to the UK or Ireland or Norway for 6 months, come back, they have a totally different thought system. They're not the same. And is that something that you've noticed yourself?
Well, I can tell you that in general, the way I grew up in the communist world, we paid little heed to the rules. So the government could introduce some kind of a rule or regulation or restriction, and people generally ignored it. And the government didn't, I have to say that the government in the former Yugoslavia was not a very draconian type of government. It was very lenient. Even criminal fines were very lenient. So even if you got in trouble with the law, it wasn't it wasn't like in the United States that you got 20 years for shoplifting. And so there I observed that people tend to be very cavalier with the rules. Jaywalking, for example. But then, if the same people go to Germany and they see everybody waiting for the red man to turn into the green man to cross the road, then people adapt very quickly. I don't know what's better, but I think that it was, life in former Yugoslavia was okay until we had the war. It was good. It was actually very good. I actually do remember my friends and I, when we were 16, 17, that we were actually talking about how incredibly fortunate we were to be growing up in that place at that time, because it really was good. And then when I was 17, I went to the United States. And when I moved to the United States from the communist world, all the Americans assumed that I would just be mesmerized by their freedoms. But I couldn't quite convey to them that I felt a lot less free in the United States than I did in the communist Yugoslavia. And I didn't really know how to explain that until recently. I wrote a Substack article about this. And then it was the reader comments that finally brought it back home to me what it was. It was exactly our ignoring of the rules and regulations and the restrictions that made us free. So, our freedom didn't come from the government. Our freedom came from us simply claiming it because it was our birthright. Whereas, if you live in the United States, there's millions of rules and regulations and restrictions, when you can drink, and people are very afraid of crossing the line. So they kind of police, for the most part, people police themselves. And so you can't do this, you can't do that, this is forbidden, that's restricted. And so that is why I didn't feel very free in the United States, because you can't do this. Oh, can I do this? No, you cannot. Can I go there? No, you cannot. Simple things. All the land is private everywhere, almost. And so I lived in Southern California, where there was like this Indian tribe that used to live there. I mean, not Indian, Native American. And so there were like archaeological things to see there. And so I wanted to explore those trails around the hills. And everywhere I went, it said no trespassing private property, no trespassing private property. So all I could do is stay on the road. I thought, well, that sucks. I just wanted to go and explore where these Native Americans used to live before we killed them all, you know. I don't know. I didn't answer your question, but
no.
You know, it's in. I understand the gist of the discussion. I just don't know how to. I can only give you my personal observations. I can't really answer.
Okay. Give kind of hope, and because a lot of people think we're doomed and gloom, but what I can see is, one, there's way more people kind of understanding and studying sovereignty, common law, and things like that. And that I had an interview just today with a guy, and he's creating open source AI that is kind of predicting the future, but based on a consensus. So when it's decentralized, as opposed to all the big boys owning it and kind of, you know, telling you what is true. And I mean, we're well aware they removed all natural kind of stuff and they put up all toxic things. That's okay. So when you see people that are kind of going down that route and they're at least there's a bit of positivity instead of thinking, oh, let's throw in the white towel, we're done for.
Yeah, yeah. No, I don't think we're done by any stretch of the imagination. I think that we're going to be free by simply claiming our freedom. We're never going to get it from the governments. And it's not the governments to give it to us. We just have to simply claim it, you know. And when they say, well, you cannot do this, then we have to say, watch me, and do it anyway, you know, not comply. That's all. That's as simple as that is. If the rule is unjustified and it's stupid and it's counterproductive and you perceive that it's doing, that it's being implemented just to, frustrate you, humiliate you, limit you in some way, then you reject the rule and you claim your freedom, which is yours, given to you by God on this earth where you were born, which is all your birthright. It's your birthright. You know, a government can take it away from you because they didn't give it to you. That's not where it comes from.
Absolutely. Listen, thoroughly enjoyed, Alex. I'll pass you on to Hartmut.
Hi, Hartmut.
My pleasure, Alex. Really my pleasure to have you here on the show.
Thank you.
It's, first of all, I want to say something about Ukraine and about the situation in Ukraine. We see now on Instagram, we see movies or videos in which they show that also young people have to go to the front and have to fight. Yeah, and the problem is that the chance to live in or to chances to survive at the front is less than 5 hours. And the modern strategy of the military is that the people in the front have to kill, let's say, the Russians or the enemy, and then in the back, another row, who has the order to kill the people in the first line if they don't shoot right.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the third row, and then you have the third row as well. So this is very, maybe an effective but very sad strategy how we do military, or how we do.
Well, yes, it's very effective at getting 1,000 Ukrainians killed every day.
Yes.
Yes, for no good reason, because they're losing the war anyway.
Yeah, they lost. Like I said in the last, I think in the last podcast, they lost it already because and everyone knows it.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, but no one cares. Yeah, and it's small. A war has the aim to change the structure within the country. And according to Zelensky, Ukraine shall become a modern state according to the World Economic Forum, with smart cities, with everything. Yeah, and this is the best way to do it. So you have to make a war, and then you can change the society in the best way.
Yes. Well, you know, that wasn't invented in Ukraine. You know, they came straight from Ukraine's sponsors in the West, who are certifiably deranged. And not only deranged, they're flat out stupid. It just doesn't work that way. But in the process, they managed to sacrifice a whole nation as their social experiment, in their endeavor to destroy Russia. It didn't work except to destroy Ukraine.
But, yes, you know, the target is to make Russia busy with Europe, so that the US can concentrate their fight and war on China.
Yes. Correct. That's exactly how I see it as well.
Yeah. The problem is we are facing so many layers of confrontation in our society like never before.
Yes.
Yeah. I say we have the horizontal war and we have the vertical war. A vertical war, for example, is a classical war to conquer land. So in that case, if you conquer land, all the people who are in this land, whether they are rich or whether they are poor, they suffer in the same way.
Yes.
And so there is a commitment between the people in order to fight back, in order to get back their land, in order to create freedom and space.
Yes.
And on the other hand, we have the economical war, for example, by measurements, by... which is a horizontal war, so that the people who earn less money disappear, and no one knows it.
Yes.
Yeah. And then the third war is on the war on education. Yeah, it's in my opinion, the whole structure is the establishment of a satanic society, and the satanic society is the establishing of a society who are psychopaths and narcissists, yes, without any empathy.
I think you're right. And this, in a way, I think is good news, because I think it's so radically contrary to our nature, is that it's getting rejected across the board. You know, as we talked a few minutes ago with Roy, you know, they've done everything in Ireland for this referendum, for everybody to vote yes, and then, you know, a huge majority of the people voted no anyway, because I think that it ran so contrary to everything that we are about, that, you know, that it doesn't matter how brainwashed you are, at some point you think, like, this is not right. This can't possibly be right. And so I think that they've largely lost the battle for the human mind. And now it's just a question of what issue comes up. You know, is it the attack of children in school with the woke ideology and transgenderism, and then, you know, people in large numbers start pulling their children out of school? I am an example of this. You know, I find it surreal that I tell my children, study math, learn how to read and write, learn geography, learn natural sciences, everything else, just get a passing grade and don't believe anything they teach you. I mean, this is my advice to my own children, which, you know, if somebody had told me when I was younger that this would be the case, I would think, well, you're crazy. That's nuts. What I remember when I was growing up, we had to get good grades, because that's how you get into a good school, to get into a good university, to get a good job. So you had to take the whole thing very seriously. And then within one generation, I'm telling my children, don't believe anything they teach you in school.
Yeah.
That's just crazy. That is just crazy. So it's like living in a lunatic asylum. To tell your children when they go to school, like, don't believe anything they teach you. And I haven't come to that easily. I just saw some of the stuff that they brought home in their curriculum. And then the French education system is not even half as bad as what I hear parents from Canada or Britain or United States tell me, which is it's just horrifying.
It's very interesting. I watched an Instagram profile of a lady who was a tortured victim by the American facilities. And Paris Hilton is someone who is fighting for these children right now, very much. We are talking about facilities, for example, in which children go for 6 months, and in general from very wealthy families. Such a facility costs $200,000 for 6 months. And the parents get convinced that the children learn to become a very good servant and to learn to responsibility. But it is opposite the case. So the children get tortured. They were robbed the dignity. For example, in the first 3 days, she wrote that she has to stay in a box of glass, naked, and that the children were tortured psychologically over 6 months. And
oh my God,
what we don't know is that, and this is what she posted. There are 6,043 facilities in the U.S. And annually, there goes 200,000 children through this kind of facilities. And several facilities are already closed because of because the rate for suicide of the children was too high. So, and this is a $40 billion industry. Let's say 200,000 children, $200,000, $40 billion.
That is truly satanic. That truly is satanic.
And now, I want to explain something. The situation is the children will, and the children are between 13, 14, 15. So these are this is the age where the children create their own will.
Yes.
And this will be destroyed. And if these children are very traumatized, they lose. Let's say they go in the survival mode and they live in the survival mode for many, many years. And if children are in the survival mode, they are traumatized and they get an egocentric, narcissistic behavior.
Yeah.
And I got this idea. I thought, wow, 200,000 children annually. Let's say they do it since the 80s. Let's say they do it since the 80s. So they have collected a lot of knowledge how to traumatize children. And now switch this knowledge in the marketing. And then, for example, education of sexual freedom from 0 to 4. These children in the Chinese, in the alternative Chinese medicine, the sexual act is an act of violence itself. Only love can transform it. So the children get traumatized. Maybe. I have to be very careful. I have to be careful. And when the children get traumatized, what do the children? They have not the ability with 3-4 years to overcome this trauma by confrontation. So the only way to deal with this kind of trauma is to escape. But the children cannot escape from the family, and the children cannot escape from the school or from the kindergarten. So the children have the possibility to escape in the gender. So they have 60 genders, and the children can change the genders every year whenever they want to. And in that case, the children is, it's looking for, it's very difficult to find an identity for themselves.
Yes.
And they are not able to, and without identity, they are not able to love. They are not able to feel real empathy.
Yeah.
And they can be controlled very easily. Yes.
Yeah. That is absolutely tragic. That is absolutely tragic. The children are probably the most important guarantor of our future. And if you break them, then you're, God knows what you're creating. God only knows what you're creating.
This is, I was 3 hours ago in the train, and I had a nice conversation with the mother, and she said she is very happy that she can educate this 2-year-old boy with her husband, so that she is doing it in the morning and she is doing it, and he is doing it in the evening, in the afternoon. But the most parents in Germany, they don't have the money anymore. They have to give the children with 8 months to the kita.
Yes.
Because of the money.
They have to work. Yeah.
They have to work.
Yeah.
So the children are in the responsibility of the kitas, kindergarten, etc.
Yeah.
It's and to understand this and to understand how the brain is triggered is, in my opinion, very important, because we have to, you can see it in all the TV shows when the people discuss. People who have empathy, they have argumentation on an objective level. And all the narcissists, in my opinion, they only make personal attacks.
Right.
Yeah. And this is, and also by watching these kind of shows, we see how a narcissistic society works by watching these kind of conversations.
Yeah. Not this kind of a conversation. Right?
Not this kind of conversation. Not this kind of conversation. But
yeah.
Because we bring objective argumentation. This is different.
Yeah. Okay, so in my case, I was very... See, I had a fortune and a misfortune. When my children are very small, I went through a divorce. Well, they were not very small. They were 6 and 8. And I was very panicked that we were going to traumatize our children and that they're going to end up damaged and scarred emotionally and unbalanced and all of these things. And I was I had a neighbor, you know, who was a victim of a very bad divorce and a violent father, abusive father, who was abusive to him and to his mother. And so he suffered greatly. And he spent half his life in psychiatric hospitals and therapy and, you know, on different kinds of medications. But he had a certain depth to him, you know, and so he had a dog and I had a dog and we walked the dogs around the neighborhood. So eventually you start a conversation. And then he told me, well, you know, I could see that the relationship between you and your wife is not so great. And then I asked him, as I learned his story, I thought, well, what would you do if you were me? What would be the one piece of advice you would give me as a father to my children? And he said like, everything will be fine. Just love them and make sure that they know that you love them. That's all.
Yes.
And so, you know, that had a profound impact on me, because it came from a person who learned it the hard way, you know, like who learned it as a victim of not getting the love. and then suffering for it, and knowing what he craved in his life and in his upbringing. And so I've been, you know, like I've been religious about that. And so I realized that in raising children, you know, your role is exactly that. Pretty much everything else, they learn on their own. There are so many things that you think you're going to teach them, but they get it from somewhere else, or they get it from themselves, or, you know, they get opinionated very early. So they even, you know, you want to teach them something, but they like, no, you know, they reject it. they have their own idea.
They do.
Yeah. And so I thought, like, okay, my job is to be their father, to make sure that they feel safe and secure, in that they have my love and my support. And then from there on, my job is to make sure that they have, that they're healthy, that they're well fed, and that they have a good sense of self-esteem, you know. And then they're going to do fine, you know. They're going to discover what they're interested in, what they want to do. And anyway, you know, we went off on a tangent, but I think it's an important tangent, because really how we do with our children is how the future is going to look like.
Yes, definitely. And there was a German journalist. His name is Peter Hane. And he was in the 20 years ago or 10 years ago, he was the moderator of the German news. And he is very famous now because he works a lot with common sense and is also very religious. And he told a very nice story, because he walked through a dark place, and there was a class of children, and the children asked him something, and he answered, and then one children said, "Hey, we know your voice." Yeah. Are you Peter Hane? I said, "Yes, I am." And then he said, "Hey, you are our favorite. You are our star in the school, but the teachers, they hate you." so the children have the resistance,
and the
and the teachers hate him because he is not left.
And
this is also very interesting. I asked two or three days ago, I had a long conversation with someone who worked for the police, and I asked him, how is it possible that people with intelligence and people, because in the ministry there are many people who are intelligent and are competent, and I asked him, how is it possible that everything can change so smoothly without a real resistance? Yeah. And he said that over the years, over the last years, the positions, special positions, were be transformed or were changed to people who have the, let's say, the woke idea, who live the woke idea. And this is the reason why we don't see so much resistance from, why we don't see any resistance from the people where we would assume that they would protect us.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense.
But you said you're ex-Yugoslavia, and the thing is about, you knew that the government, let's say, was crap, and that you have to manage the things by yourself. This was the reason, for example, if you wanted to paint a wall in a factory, you needed 100 liter of color, because everyone took some color. Yeah.
Right.
And this I miss at the moment, because we have here the impression, let's say in in the GDR, the people, 50% thought that the government was right and 80% thought that the government is wrong. And now in the Western world, we have the feeling that 80%, let's say, okay, it becomes less, but still 60, 70% think that the government is right, and maybe 30% think that the government is wrong. This transformation is, the only way is talking. Yeah.
Yes.
And the problem is, for example, in Germany, that the restrictions become very tough, and that also the news attack people who think differently. And people of the Green Party, they don't hide anymore that, for example, if they say everyone who doesn't think like myself is a Nazi, they don't hide this kind of thought anymore.
Well, I wonder how long that can last.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think maybe it'll become a little bit like the reality of communism in Yugoslavia, because there was a very strong, powerful ideological foundation to that society, except that, over time people stopped caring. Even policemen, military people, judges, prosecutors, they don't go to work thinking about what can I do today to defend our revolution and to uphold communism. They think about, what they're going to do over the weekend. They're going to invite some friends over for a barbecue and some drinks. And people get tired of ideology. People always end up falling back on their core values, which are, simple stuff: living a good life, having friends, having family, raising your children. And all this wokery is going to get old. I think it's already getting very old.
Yes, I hope so. I hope so.
Yeah,
I saw a doc in Ireland. There was one of the guys, Ivor Cummins, he was on my show, and he was showing the training for the teachers, and it was done in a cartoon. And it was basically, yeah, if the boy decides he wants to be a girl, that's okay. If vice versa, if you want to be non-binary, this is the education system that's being taught now to the teachers for the schools. So they're pushing it harder even in Ireland, even though I think because it's been exposed, there's going to be serious uproar. And I think people are realizing who is the teacher to dictate, what a child should be. Whereas before, I think in my age, it was a case of they kind of let the teachers do what they want to do. Whereas now my youngest is 10. I'm totally like yourself, Alex. I'm paying full attention to what's going on and making sure, he's in a decent school, is copying the Finnish system, but just hearing what's going on. I think the days of when you just hand your kid over to the schooling system and you do your thing, if you want the world to change, you don't allow that crap to happen, and you step in immediately, because we make change at local level.
Agreed.
The point is, it's a question also of culture. I saw a very interesting video a couple of years ago. There was a guy who sold drugs at the school, at the entrance of the school. And in let's say in Germany, I think not a lot would happen. Maybe police would be called one time and that's it. And in this country, which is very fast, is in the east. Some parents came, some fathers came, who were a little bit stronger, and who explained to him that this is not healthy for him to stand in front of the entrance. And if you can't see it, I could see what they did to him, and I think he will never stay there again.
Oh. Yeah, in the end, you know, in the end, it comes to that. You know,
in the end, it comes to that.
There's going to be strong discouragement from ordinary people against these, you know, socio-political commissars who think that they're going to enforce some new stupid rules and restrictions and everybody has to abide. Guess what? It's not going to work.
No. No. It's like a pendulum. Yeah. It goes in this one direction. And I suppose if it goes in this, the one direction, it goes also in the other one. Yeah. If it goes in the other one, it can be very tough.
Yes. 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 Yeah. So, well, you know, it's gonna be on the conscience of those who started swinging the pendulum around.
Yeah. Yeah. The problem is, in the economical situation, what we have right now, they only increase the heat of a waterfall. In order to crash the market, and not, they can do it immediately, but they are increasing the heat so that everyone will be taken with this crash.
Yeah.
And with respect to the culture clash, for example, between Muslims and, for example, the woke society, there's also this kind of increasing the culture clash. The most mosques in Europe were established after the war in Yugoslavia. Because,
oh, is that right?
Let's say it this way, 90% of the mosques in Europe are founded by a foundation which is owned by Saudi Arabia.
Yes. Yeah.
And which is in ex-Yugoslavia, in one of the countries. I don't know which one.
Probably Bosnia, yeah.
Yeah. And now we have in Germany, 2,800 mosques, and in whole Europe, 8,000. Which is a lot.
That's a lot, yes.
And now we have all the refugees. And for example, in Germany, the German Ministry for Foreign Affairs, an embassy makes advertisement in an Arabic country how easy it is to get the German passport. So they describe on Twitter what they have to do in order to get the German passport, how they get the money in Germany, it's unbelievable. So they increase the quantity of Arabic people in Germany, and on the same time they increase the woke society.
Yeah.
Well, gentlemen, thank you very much.
Okay. Hartmut
Schumacher of Go Your Own Path, Roy Colan of AwakeningPodcast.org, and yours truly, Grace Asagra of Quantum Nurse Podcast. We first, Roy, Hartmut, always thank you for hosting. And Alex, as always, you see, we can never stop really having this conversation, as you said. And so we need a lot more of your presence as we continue to, you know, make a difference. So Alex, when you started with that, you walked us through the dichotomy of socialism and capitalism. How about you just summarize us and walk us again through the scenario that what we can do so that we could have that equilibrium that you mentioned? Because in my understanding, it seems like when we keep labeling things as good and bad, this and that, it isn't really. It's a matter of who. It's a matter of who we are, what we are. So walk us through that summary for having that picture?
Okay, so just to put it in the briefest possible version of it, we all have in socialist governments and capitalist governments, we always have a very strong role of government in our economies. The difference between what we call capitalist economies and what we call socialist economies, that in the capitalist economies, government intervention in the economy goes top down, meaning that the government provides purchasing power primarily to the large banks and corporations. That's their conduit for intervening into the economy. In what we call socialist systems, the governments principally inject purchasing power bottom up, meaning they're generous with unemployment benefits, with pensions, with things like free education and free healthcare or inexpensive healthcare and education and various other social programs and infrastructure that get people employed and off the streets. So, that's not necessarily evil, and we have to understand the difference. But we also have to understand why it is essential for governments to intervene in the economy, because we keep getting fed the fairy tales about, well, you know, like conservatives, politicians will come and then they will like campaign on small government and balancing the budget and paying down the debts, except please show me one economy in this world where this is actually done. It doesn't exist. So, you know, these politicians either don't know what they're promising or they're lying. Because as long as we have the monetary system that we have, certain outcomes are guaranteed. So, you know, we have to think about two things. While we have this monetary system in effect, we have to think about the balance between, you know, social benefits and the system of private capitalism. But more importantly, we need to think about how to reform the monetary system so that we don't have these dichotomies in the first place, which is also possible, but it needs clarity, it needs transparency and discussion. And this is exactly what we're being deprived of. Because, you know, if you go study economics, nobody's going to teach you how the monetary system works. In fact, they're going to teach you this in a way that will make sure that you have no idea. So that's why most people don't understand it, not because it's so complicated, but because they made it so complicated so that nobody would understand it. Okay. I would like to ask to finish with one thought. That, you know, I came across a documentary film a little scene that made me ponder. And this is the scene. So the BBC documentary crew was following a group of Bushmen who injured a giraffe, and then they ran after it, right? And this was a very long run. I think this took several days. So the giraffe is trying to escape, but they run after it until they exhaust the animal and then they kill it. And so they ran after this giraffe, and at night they set up a campfire. And then at the campfire, you know, had their social moment, talking and joking and laughing. And the man who was making the documentary film, he asked him, but what about the giraffe, you know? Why don't we talk about the giraffe? And the Bushman said like, oh, no, we don't talk about the giraffe. And they said, but why? And the Bushman answered, because us talking about the giraffe is making the giraffe stronger. So we might not be able to catch it. And, you know, this made me kind of stop and think, because you know, maybe their ancient wisdom is valid. And the point for me is that, you know, like we are, as Hartmut said, we are beset by a thousand battles. We're being attacked on all sides, vertically and laterally and in all ways. And we find ourselves mesmerized and transfixed by what's going on. And we tend to put a lot of attention into this, and we talk about all these bad things, while at the same time, we're not focusing on the world that we want to build, you know? And so, you know, even Nietzsche said, like, if you look into the abyss, you have to be careful because the abyss is looking back at you. So I think that we have to try to make a conscious effort to take our, well, obviously we have to understand the attack that's coming at us. But beyond understanding it, we need to shift our focus on the world that we want to create for the future. So not to think about the giraffe too much, but about all the wonderful recipes we're gonna make after we kill the giraffe.
What a perfect ending. So why don't you invite our viewers to your work, Substack and other things? Okay.
Well, you know, I'm easy to find on X. My handle is @NakedHedgy. And my Substack is Alex Craner's Trend Compass. So that should be easy to find.
And to all of you there, so don't please remember, okay, as the wokeism is getting weaker, so now we could always say that we're awake when we're aware and we're able, and really we just have to remember and recall all the things that we can do. And so remember to like, subscribe, support in every way possible, monetary or sharing, and do take care of yourselves no matter what. Don't let anyone take the joy out of your life. Take care, and Alex Craner, thank you, and have a safe trip next month, and we'll see you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Grace, Hartmut, Roy, always a pleasure to join you, and I look forward to the next time.
Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.